Section 3, The Rise of Segregation, An American Story. In the fall of 1892, H.S. Doyle, a young African-American preacher, defied Georgia's power structure, dominated by whites and Democrats, by giving more than 60 speeches on behalf of a white populist, Tom Watson, who was running for Congress. Doyle took that risk because Watson was doing something almost unbelievable for a Southern politician. He was urging poor whites and blacks to unite against the wealthy white elite. "You are kept apart that you may be separately fleeced of your earnings," Watson told a racially mixed audience at one gathering. "The accident of color can make no difference in the interests of farmers." Shortly before the election, Doyle himself received a death threat. Watson offered the preacher refuge in his home and alerted supporters in the area. An estimated 2,000 populace gathered there with guns in hand. The crowd then marched to the local courthouse, where Watson vowed to protect Doyle and other African-American populace. "We are determined in this free country that the humblest white or black man that wants to talk our doctrine shall do it," he declared. "And the man doesn't live who shall touch a hair of his head without fighting every man in the People's Party." Adapted from Tom Watson, Agrarian Rebel. Resistance and Repression. For H.S. Doyle and other African Americans, the violence of the election of 1892 was not something they could shrug off. They could see that some Southern leaders were beginning to devise ways to keep them from voting. In the end, even Watson would betray his African American supporters. He became a political boss in Georgia, cast aside his former ideals, and used crude racist rhetoric to appeal to white voters. After Reconstruction, many African Americans in the rural South lived in conditions that were little better than slavery. They were technically free, but few escaped from grinding poverty. Most were sharecroppers, landless farmers who had to hand over to the landlord a large portion of their crops to cover the cost of rent, seed, tools, and other supplies. They were always in debt. Many eventually left farming and sought jobs in southern towns or headed west to claim homesteads. Exodus to Kansas. In 1879, 70-year-old Benjamin Pap Singleton, himself formerly enslaved, took action to escape the conditions of the rural South. He organized a mass migration of thousands of African Americans from the rural South to Kansas. The newspapers called it an exodus, like the Hebrews' escape from Egyptian bondage. The migrants themselves came to be known as Exodusters. One of them later explained why they went. The whole South, every state in the South, had got into the hands of the very men that held us as slaves. A journalist named Henry King described the scene when the first group reached Kansas. One morning in April 1879, a Missouri steamboat arrived at Wyandotte, Kansas, and discharged a load of Negro men, women, and children, with barrels, boxes, and bundles of household effects. Their garments were incredibly patched and tattered, and there was not probably a dollar in money in the pockets of the entire party. The wind was eager, and they stood upon the wharf shivering. They looked like persons coming out of a dream, and indeed such they were, for this was the advance guard of the Exodus. Quoted in Eyewitness, The Negro in History. Forming a Separate Alliance. While some African Americans fled the South, others joined with poor white farmers who had created the Farmers' Alliance. Alliance leaders urged African Americans to form a similar organization. In 1886, African American farmers gathered in Texas at the home of a white minister named R.M. Humphrey and formed the Colored Farmers National Alliance. By 1890, the organization had an estimated 1.2 million members. The Colored Farmers National Alliance worked to help its members economically by setting up cooperatives. When the Populist Party formed in 1891, many African American farmers joined the new organization. They hoped that the new People's Party would unite poor whites and poor blacks to challenge the Democratic Party's power in the South. Crushing the Populist Revolt. Populism posed a new challenge to the Democratic Party in the South. If enough poor whites left the party and joined with African American populace, the coalition might become unbeatable. To win back the poor white vote, Democratic leaders began appealing to racism, warning whites that support for populist or joint Republican populist parties would return the South to black Republican rule, similar to Reconstruction. In addition, although many African Americans in the South were still able to vote as of 1890, election officials began using various methods to make it harder and harder for them to do so. As one Democratic leader in the South told a reporter, "Some of our people, some editors especially, deny that African Americans are hindered from voting. But what is the good of lying? They are interfered with, and we are obliged to do it, and we may as well tell the truth." Reading check. Examining. Who were the Exodusters, and why did they migrate to Kansas in 1879? Disfranchising African Americans. The 15th Amendment prohibited states from denying citizens the right to vote on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. However, it did not bar the governments from requiring that citizens be literate or own property in order to vote. Using this loophole, southern states began imposing restrictions that barred nearly all African Americans from voting, even though the restrictions seemed on the surface to apply to both races. Mississippi took this step first in 1890 by requiring that all citizens registering to vote pay a poll tax of $2, a sum beyond the means of most poor African Americans. Mississippi also instituted a literacy test, requiring that prospective voters be able to read or understand the state constitution. More than half of all African Americans who came of age in the South after the Civil War had no school to attend, and those who had grown up under slavery were largely illiterate. Even those who knew how to read often failed the literacy test because local officials deliberately picked complicated passages that few could understand. Other southern states later adopted similar restrictions, and the results were devastating. In Louisiana, the number of African Americans registered to vote fell from about 130,000 in 1890 to around 5,300 in 1900. In Alabama, the number fell from about 181,000 to around 3,700. Election officials were far less strict in applying the poll tax and literacy requirements to whites, but the number of white voters also fell significantly. Local Democratic Party leaders were not sorry to see poor whites barred from voting because they had helped fuel the populist revolt. Some states gave whites a special break, however, by including a so-called grandfather clause in the restrictions. The grandfather clause in Louisiana allowed any man to vote if he had an ancestor on the voting rolls in 1867. The clause made almost all formerly enslaved Louisiana citizens ineligible to vote. Reading check. Identifying. How did southern states restrict African American voting in the 1890s? Legalizing segregation. Discrimination in the late 1800s was not confined to the South. African Americans in the North had often been barred from many public places used by whites. In the South, segregation, or separation of the races, was different because laws enforced and perpetuated the discrimination. The statutes enforcing segregation were known as Jim Crow laws. The term probably came from the name of a character popularized by a slavery-era blackface minstrel, a white musical stage performer who darkened his face with makeup and crudely imitated supposed African-American behavior. In 1883, the Supreme Court set the stage for legalized segregation by overturning the Civil Rights Act of 1875. That law had prohibited keeping people out of public places on the basis of race, and it also prohibited racial discrimination in selecting jurors. White authorities challenged the law in both the North and the South. The 1883 Supreme Court decision, however, said that the 14th Amendment only provided that no state could deny citizens equal protection under the law. Thus, only state actions were subject to challenge. private organizations and businesses, such as hotels, theaters, and railroads, were free to practice segregation. Encouraged by the Supreme Court's ruling and by the decline of congressional support for civil rights, southern states passed a series of laws that enforced segregation in virtually all public places. Southern whites and African Americans could no longer ride together in the same railroad cars, eat in the same dining halls, or even drink from the same water fountains. Restrooms, hotels, and swimming pools were all segregated. In 1892, an African American named Homer Plessy challenged a Louisiana law that forced him to ride in a separate railroad car from whites. He was arrested for riding in a whites-only car and brought to trial before criminal court judge John H. Ferguson. Ferguson rejected Plessy's argument that the law was unconstitutional. In 1896, the Supreme Court in Plessy v. Ferguson upheld the Louisiana law and expressed a new legal doctrine endorsing separate but equal facilities for African Americans. The ruling established the legal basis for discrimination in the South for more than 50 years to come. While public facilities for African Americans in the South were always separate, they were far from equal. In many cases, they were inferior. Racial violence. Even worse than the Jim Crow laws was the brutality leveled against African Americans. In the late 1800s, mob violence increased in the United States, particularly in the South. Between 1890 and 1899, there was an average of 187 lynchings, executions without proper court proceedings, carried out by mobs each year. Over 80% of the lynchings occurred in the South, and nearly 70% of the victims were African Americans. Reading check. Summarizing. How did the Supreme Court help to legalize segregation? The African American response. In 1892, Ida B. Wells, a fiery young African-American woman from Tennessee, launched a fearless crusade against lynching. Wells pointed out that greed, not just racial prejudice, was often behind these brutal acts. Writing in the Memphis Free Speech newspaper, she reported that three African-American grocers lynched in Memphis had been guilty of nothing more than competing successfully against white grocers. A mob destroyed the press that printed the Memphis Free Speech and drove Wells out of town. But she settled in Chicago and continued her campaign. In 1895, she published a book denouncing mob violence against African Americans and demanding a fair trial by law for those accused of crime and punishment by law after honest conviction. Although Congress rejected an anti-lynching bill, the number of lynchings decreased significantly in the 1900s, due in great part to the efforts of activists such as Wells. A call for compromise. Some African American leaders like Wells chose the path of protest, but others recommended different solutions to discrimination. One such person was the influential educator Booker T. Washington. He proposed that African Americans concentrate on achieving economic goals rather than legal or political ones. In 1895, he summed up his views in a speech before a mostly white audience at the Cotton States and International Exposition in Atlanta. Known as the Atlanta Compromise, the address came amid increasing acts of discrimination against African Americans. Washington urged his fellow African Americans to postpone the fight for civil rights and instead concentrate on preparing themselves educationally and vocationally for full equality. The wisest among my race understand that the agitation of questions of social equality is the extremest folly, and that the enjoyment of all the privileges that will come to us must be the result of severe and constant struggle rather than of artificial forcing. It is important and right that all privileges of the law be ours, but it is vastly more important that we be prepared for the exercise of these privileges. The opportunity to earn a dollar in a factory just now is worth infinitely more than the opportunity to spend a dollar in an opera house. Adapted from Up From Slavery. Voice of the Future. The Atlanta Compromise speech provoked a strong challenge from W.E.B. Du Bois, the leader of a new generation of African-American activists born after the Civil War. Du Bois pointed out in his 1903 book, The Souls of Black Folk, that white Southerners continued to strip African-Americans of their civil rights. This was true in spite of the progress African-Americans were making in education and vocational training. They could regain that lost ground and achieve full equality, Du Bois argued, only by demanding their rights. Du Bois was particularly concerned with protecting and exercising voting rights. Negroes must insist continually, in season and out of season, he wrote, that voting is necessary to proper manhood, that color discrimination is barbarism. In the years that followed, many African Americans worked to win the vote and end discrimination. The struggle, however, would prove to be a long one. Reading check. Describing. How did Ida B. Wells attempt to stop the lynching of African Americans? Critical thinking skill builder. Interpreting points of view. Why learn this skill? Suppose you want to see a new movie, but your friends' opinions range from terrific to boring. People often have different opinions about the same people, events, or issues because they look at them from different points of view. Learning the skill. A point of view results from one's own beliefs and values. Many factors affect an individual's point of view, including age, gender, racial or ethnic background, economic class, and religion. To judge the accuracy or the objectivity of an argument, you must first identify the speaker's point of view. To interpret point of view in written material, gather background information on the author that might reveal his or her point of view. Identify aspects of the topic that the author chooses to emphasize or exclude. Look for emotionally charged words, such as charming, vicious, heartwarming, and drastic. Also notice metaphors and analogies that imply an opinion, such as, if this budget can work, then pigs can fly. Practicing the skill. Read the following excerpts from William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech, then answer the questions. The humblest citizen in all the land, when clad in the armor of a righteous cause, is stronger than all the hosts of error. I come to speak to you in defense of a cause as holy as the cause of liberty, the cause of humanity. When you come before us and tell us that we are about to disturb your business interest, we reply that you have disturbed our business interest by your course. We say not one word against those who live upon the Atlantic coast, but the hardy pioneers who have braved all the dangers of the wilderness, who have made the desert to blossom as the rose, it is for these that we speak. If they ask us why it is that we say more on the money question than we say upon the tariff question, I reply that if protection has slain its thousands, the gold standard has slain its tens of thousands. Having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interest, the laboring interests, and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold. 1. What subject is Bryan addressing? What group is he speaking for? 2. What is Bryan's point of view? 3. What emotionally charged words and phrases does Bryan use in his speech? How does this language help reveal his point of view? Applying the skill. Interpreting points of view. In a newspaper or magazine, find an editorial or letter to the editor that expresses a point of view on an issue. Write a paragraph analyzing the author's point of view. Compare it to your own and explain why you agree or disagree with the author. Glencoe's Skill Builder Interactive Workbook CD-ROM Level 2 provides instruction and practice in key social studies skills.